The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Last time, we went over Christ's statement that he was the vine and that we were the branches off of that vine. And it means that we receive our strength and our nourishment from him. And it means that we're actually a part of him. We are a part of the same family, the same species, actually, that is the God family, and the same life is in us, in embryo, as it were. And so the vine, we learn, has branches that grow, and they're all clinging to something strong, and the thing that we all cling to is the Father, and that is where we get our strength, our direction, and our life. Tonight we're going to learn more about this, being branches on the vine, because Christ continues to talk in this context. So let's go to John 15, if you will, and we'll start in verse 16, where it says this: "You have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, and ordained you that you should go forth and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain. And whatsoever you shall ask the Father in my name, then he may give it to you." So at that time, it was the custom of students to choose their particular rabbi. But Christ wanted to make certain that they, in their time, and we today, understand this vital truth. None of us choose Jesus Christ. Now, most churches today reverse this entire process. They send people out to try to convert others. They believe this is, in fact, the mission of the church. And this was taught really vigorously during the Middle Ages, of course. They believed at that time that they had to convert the world before Christ could come. They would convert people. It meant so much to them. They would convert them at the point of a sword. They thought that whatever they did to people could never be anything worse than the horrible fires of an eternal burning hell. Therefore, they would torture people until they agreed to accept Christ. Then once the individual accepted Jesus, then they would then kill him or her. In that way, they would never be able to recant. And so they thought they were doing good, and they were killing people, thinking they were doing God a service. And the Church of God is very different from that. We don't torture you with fire, and we don't torture you with sword. Instead, we simply torture you with long sermons and Bible studies. Look, all kidding aside, let's go to John 6. All kidding aside, just this wrong concept alone has caused so much evil in the world. Today, missionaries will stop people on the street. They'll come to your house to try to convince you to accept Christ. But think how this view horribly distorts the truth of God. Because they teach that Jesus is God. They picture him loving us enough to die and suffer for us in order to save us. Yet their approach is as if he's begging people to accept him. Look around. It appears that very few are accepting him, especially today. In today's world, less and less. Fewer people are believing in him at all. Our entire society is, in fact, turning against professing Christianity. They mock and ridicule it openly, giving preference even to other religions like the Muslim faith. So we find ourselves in exactly the same position as ancient Israel. That is, we're no different than those in apostate Judah. We have rejected God, the nation has, and accepted false gods and false ways instead. Now, this wrong view of us choosing Christ helped achieve this, what I call mockery, because it makes God appear incredibly weak to mankind. It doesn't portray him as the magnificent, all-powerful, majestic, glorious king that he is. Instead, it gives the power to the human person, and it takes it from the transcendent God. makes people think the choice, oh, it's really up to them. So Jesus is sending all these people out and he wants so bad to be accepted, and he leaves it up to them whether they'll accept him or not. But nothing, absolutely nothing could be further from the truth. All of this is a massive deception. The whole world is deceived, and this is one of the ways in which it is. Neither we nor anyone can choose him, even if we wanted to. No one can come to him, understand him, or know him by their own power or their own choice. Now, certainly, sure, there are people out there that accept some passages from the Bible. There are sincere people who may want to do some things right, but they can't decide to know the true Christ or the truth of his Bible. It is impossible unless the Father calls them. And that's why it says here in John 6, in verse 44, and in verse 65, it says, no man can come to me except the Father, which has sent me, draw him, and I'll raise him up the last day. So everything is within God's power and not ours. And the Almighty sets the limits on how far even the devil can go. He allows men to have positions of power, but it's for his divine purpose, and nobody is in power unless he accepts it or agrees to it. Doesn't matter who you or I or anybody else thinks should be in power. It doesn't really matter how you vote. The final outcome is completely in his hands. People think that more money would have elected McCain in this past election. But these people are wrong, and it was obvious even from the start. Even with all the lies we were told and that we saw that were evident, you know, didn't make a difference. It didn't make a difference that we watched him say that Reverend Wright was his minister and that he would never forsake him, and then he forsakes him. He says he's going to take only the government funds and he's not going to accept public contributions, and then he gets so many contributions that he actually gets more campaign money than anyone has ever received, and it came in $200 and less donations that just kept flooding in from foreign sources, and he gets all of this coming in. And he changes his mind. And we see him lying about these things. And then we see him giving speeches in which the celebrities add their weight to them. And then people fainted when he spoke in his campaign messages, just like occurred with the time the Pope came here. And I say this, the last election turned out exactly the way God wanted. It's exactly what we wanted. And it's exactly what we deserved. And there is a corollary to this thinking that God somehow depends on us. I've heard more than one pastor in God's church say the following statement, and that is, Christ is taking more time to come back because the church is not yet ready. Now look, they think that the church must be righteous enough in order for him to return. But this is simply more human vanity. This teaching gives more of the power to the individual to bring Christ back. But when he came the first time, it says he came in due time. That means he came in his chosen time to come. Israel wasn't righteous enough for him to come. They actually rejected him. When it comes to the second time that Christ comes, the church is not ready for him to come. In fact, the church is so self-satisfied, he's furious with them. They're content with themselves. They're content with their lives. They're now lukewarm and unteachable, and so they're spewed out of his mouth. So Christ comes at this time in spite of our weaknesses and in spite of our failures. He comes because if he didn't come back, mankind would kill himself off. There wouldn't be any flesh left alive. So he intervenes, and he intervenes to correct the church at that time and to make them ready. It's not about us or the power we have. It's about him and the power he has. Everything is in the hands of the Almighty, and it's not in our hands. He chooses who he's going to call. Christ then picks those within the Father's will, works with each one to bring them to the salvation as he wills. And even of those who are called, he's only going to choose a few of them. He's going to take, as it were, you could say, the cream of the crop. He won't choose those who just accept him or who profess him. He's only going to choose those who are faithful to him. So, we don't choose him. We have been privileged to be called. What we can choose is to obey him or not. Now, there's an enormous lesson, I believe, here for us. We've got to always keep this in the forefront of our mind. We need to know where the power lies, where it is. We need to remember who is the source of all things. So, it's in this context that Christ, brings us to be branches of the vine. As such, he says that we're to bear fruit, and we're connected to the vine that feeds the branches. So our insight, our spiritual strength, comes from the vine, from him. Any worthwhile, any enduring fruit we bear must come from him. And I ask us today to think just how important this truth is. So many today around the world are just going along on their own strength. Some cases, there are leaders that are church leaders that are claiming that they're more important than others in God's work. They're parading their fruit before their members, and their website hits is what they call their fruit. They say that their fruit is the sites, booklets that they have produced. They talk of the television audience they have, and so on. But let's go to Galatians 5. They talk about numbers is what they're talking about. And they're talking about things that are, what I think of, or I put in a category of David when he numbered Israel. He was counting how much power he had, how big his army was, and how what he could count on for support. But that's my point today, is that none of that matters. None of it matters to God. He tells us the fruits we're to produce, and that's in Galatians 5 and starting in verse 22. The fruit of the Spirit is love, it's joy, it's peace, it's long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, and temperance. And then he says, against such there is no law. And then he says, they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and the lusts. But don't you see that all this braggadocio that's happening in the churches, all of these cases where one attacks another and they call people by name and say that they're Satan's instrument or whatever, all of this stuff is not crucifying the flesh. It is the flesh wildly, human nature wildly out of control. And Paul continues, if we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not be desirous of vainglory, or provoking one another, or envying one another. So don't you see what I'm getting at? It's just sometimes we're doing the exact opposite of what we're supposed to be doing. And we think some things are fruits, but there's only one kind of fruits that God accepts. And if we're producing those kind of fruits, he's going to hear our prayers. But if we're praying and not getting answers to our prayers, where's the problem? Well, it is that we're not really producing fruit, because we're not fully attached to the vine. It's not the vine that's feeding us, it's our human nature instead. And so men may preach powerfully about their accomplishments, but they forget that we would have no power without Christ. We'd have no understanding if he didn't give it to us. We forget that it says our heart is actually deceitful and wicked. We're self-centered. We forget it. We forget that truth. And the Master states, there's none righteous, no, not even one. And he tells us that man is just a vain show, and at our best, we're only vanity. He says our righteousness, the best we can do, is like filthy rags. And then he tells us he didn't call the great and the mighty, but he called the weak of the world. You know, so if we find ourselves now in a position where we are called, and what will determine whether or not we're chosen? You understand? Many are called, but few are chosen. So we have numerous people that are called, and he's saying we've got to produce fruit and stay connected to the vine, and then only a few will be chosen. But what is the criteria he's going to use for those he's going to choose? Because he gives those who are called some pretty important advice in the next verse. Let's go back to John 15. John 15, and back to the next verse in verse 17, where he says this powerful statement: "These things I command you, that you love one another." So look, we live in this world that's now ruled by Satan the devil. Paul states that Satan is actually the god of this world, and that's why he could offer the kingdoms of the world to Christ when he tried to tempt him. And so behind these current world events that we're watching happen, these rebellions and this shifting of power all over, this is taking place because of demonic powers behind the scenes. And we have come to a point where, you know, it used to be that it was unsafe for a woman to go out at night. Now it's getting so that in our cities it's unsafe to go out at night alone, period. And this is why the Middle East is ramping up for the end time prophecies to be fulfilled. It's why corporations are now running the world now more than our governments, and it's why our government leaders are so corrupt. And it's the basis for the violence and the brutality that you and I read about every day new in the papers. The world has become a very wicked place to be. And so our Creator tells us that we're to live in this world, that we're not to be a part of the world, however. We are not to be abusing one another. Instead of taking advantage of one another, instead of resenting, hating, having hostility and resentment towards one another, he says, love one another. If you're tied to the vine, you're going to be living through the spirit that we receive through that vine, and that spirit is going to be love, joy, and peace, and long-suffering, putting up with one another and understanding one another. And I say we need to grasp this monumental point. Christ is the vine, and the Father chooses who can be branches on that vine. Our calling is to become a part of him. Therefore, we should be looking like he does, and we should be bearing the same kind of fruit he does. All of us who are called, then, he chooses of them those who bear his fruit. So in other words, in this world of hatred and hostility, we are to love. And we're in a world that is filled with selfishness. We're to be self-sacrificing. We are to be giving. We are to be helpful. We're not to be attacking one another, not to be judging and backbiting one another. You know, Time magazine told the following story. It was a man named Michael Weiser, who was a Jewish man, who lived in Lincoln, Nebraska. For more than 3 years, Larry Trapp threatened him. Trapp was the self-proclaimed Nazi Ku Klux Klansman, and he directed a torrent of hate-filled mailings to Weiser, and he would phone Weiser and threaten him over the phone. Trapp was what is called a white supremacist, and his home was just filled with anti-Semitism and racial prejudice and tracts and writings and all kinds of things like that. He actually declared himself the Grand Dragon and KKK headquarters for Lincoln, Nebraska, and that state. and his whole purpose seemed to be to spew out hate-ridden racial slurs, and many of these were directed at Weiser and others who were like him. So at first, the Weisers feared. They locked their door and they lived in worry. They locked their doors and were scared. And one day, Weiser discovered something very shocking, however. He learned that Trapp was actually clinically blind and a double amputee. And he became convinced that Trapp's helplessness is what caused a lot of his bitterness. And so Weiser decided to do something that was certainly the unexpected. He called and left a message on Trapp's answering machine. He told him there is another side of life, one free of hatred and racism. Weiser said, "I probably called at least 10 times before Trapp finally picked up." Ironically, Trapp asks Weiser, "Why are you harassing me?" And then Weiser said, "I actually called because I want to help you." And so Weiser offered him a ride to the grocery store or the mall if he ever needed it. Trapp is stunned by this. He's totally disarmed by the kindness and the courtesy of this man. But it started him thinking and wondering and questioning. Later, he admitted that he heard something in Weiser's voice. Trapp said it was something he had not heard in many years. He still recognized it, though, and he said it was love. That's what it was. Slowly, this bitter man began to soften, and one night, he called the Weisers, and he said, "I want out." And he admitted that he didn't know how to do it. So Weiser got together with Trapp. They grabbed a bucket of fried chicken, and they ate dinner together one night. And before long, they made a very interesting trade. The Weiser family gave Trapp friendship and human kindness. Trapp gave them his swastika rings, hate tracks, and Klan robes. And that day, Trapp gave up his Ku Klux Klan recruiting job, and he said the Weiser family showed him what was of real value in life. And he learned how to love again, something that he had lost. Let's go to Matthew 5, if you will. Go to Matthew 5. If that can happen to this man, Trapp, why can't it happen to us in the Church of God? It took enormous courage for Weiser to do what he did. And it takes courage from us, too, to demonstrate love to others who may believe different or be in a different group or something. But we are the called of God. You have to admit, though, that it's confusing right now. It's a confusing time in the Church of God. There's so many splits, and some are claiming they're the only ones that are right. Others are calling people names like apostates or Laodicean and all of that. It's the same mentality of Trapp. And we have to have the same mentality of Weiser. We've got to give love to others, even our enemies. So, on the other hand, I don't think it's wrong to write or preach what we believe is true. It's not wrong to demonstrate error that we perceive that is out there, but I do not think it's necessary to use names or attack others. It's not good to ridicule or put down those who believe differently than us. In the end, the vast majority of all people will end up being children of God. And there isn't any one of us that hasn't been wrong at some time in our life. None of us are without sin. Who are we to attack others or think we're superior to somebody else? If we attack others in the Church of God, or even those in politics or in this world, it's not born out of love. It comes from fear, or it comes from ego in every case. So we want to follow Christ's advice to love one another. And so in Matthew 5, if you've turned there, let's look at verse 38 and read to the end of the chapter, where he says this: You've heard that it's been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, don't resist evil, but that is that happens towards us. But whoever shall smite you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if a man will sue you at law and take away your coat, let him have your cloak also. And whosoever shall compel you to go a mile, go too. Give to him that asks you. And for him that would borrow of you, don't turn him away. You've heard that it's been said, you shall love your neighbor, and you shall hate your enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Even bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you, and even those who persecute you. Why? Why be like that? He says this, that you may be the children of your Father, which is in heaven. For he makes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust. And then it says this, if you love them that love you, well, what reward do you have? Is that godly? Do not even the publicans do the same? Yes. And if you salute your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Nothing. Do not even the publicans do so? Yes, they all do that. And then he says this powerful statement, be you therefore perfect or mature as a Christian, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. This is what we want to follow. And this is why we don't return railings for railings, as Paul speaks of, because love is the answer, and love is going to make the difference between who stays on the vine and who is finally chosen in the end. Brethren, this is our calling, and today I ask us to deeply consider this, because this is what is going to be, I think, one of the largest parts determining if we're chosen or not chosen. On the other hand, I don't want to minimize how difficult this is. If we truly reflect the love of the Savior, we are going to be really different. We're going to act more like Christ. We're going to stand out more as a target to the rest of the world who resents him and doesn't like him or his way of life. So let's go back to John 15 where we were. My point is that we can easily become, as Bible believers and livers, we can become the target for people's hostility, just like Weiser was. Therefore, Christ reassures his disciples that he understands the difficulty involved in this, and he reminds them of something pretty vital. In verse 18, he says, if the world hate you, know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. And so I don't know about you, but I know that when I first came in the Church of God, I thought, well, if I obey God, it's going to be just a yellow brick road to the kingdom. He's going to be there. He's going to answer my prayers. I'm going to get what I want and so on, you know. When I was a young boy, or at least before that, I learned in the church that it wasn't going to work that way over time, you know. But when I was a young boy, my family, my mother and I was fatherless. We moved pretty often. Looking back, I can see how important it was to be accepted, and to me it was very important. I wanted to belong to the group of kids at school. And when things, when they would do things wrong, I would generally go along and do it too. Even though I knew it was wrong, I would do it to fit in. I felt this strong need to be a part of the group. And I say that those human needs never go away. Even as adults, none of us want to feel what it feels like to be rejected. We don't want to be called names like cult. We don't want to be thought of as weird. So I ask us to consider how much of this has affected us today. How important is it for us to be accepted by others in this world? How far are we willing to bend in order to not feel alienated by them? Because the Messiah is telling us we absolutely must belong to his group, and we should crave acceptance from him and acceptance from the Father, and we should desire it so much we're willing to suffer loss for it. So this is one of the, I think, major dangers at the end of the age. We sometimes want to follow the media to some degree. We want to follow the world's fashions. We want to follow their kind of humor. So we want to follow the kind of language of those around us. And some of us want to even take part in the politics of this world. And I want to tell you something. I read this once. President Lyndon Johnson always carried the latest opinion polls with him wherever he went. Because he wanted to know what the people thought. Because that way he knew what stand he should take on different issues. But look, we should always carry God's opinion poll with us. We should have the Bible in our home and in our car. And we should have it in our heads because we continue to study it. We should consult his opinion in every decision we make. Tragically, the last era doesn't do this. They tend to follow and are tending to follow the corporate model. As a result, God says, I'm going to spew them out of my mouth. Now, why is he saying this? He's not eternally cutting them off in his anger, not just a punishment. By this, isn't he saying, you like the world's ways too much? And I'm just going to go ahead and spew you right into the world you like so much. See how you like it in the tribulation. So my point is we should always remember this truth. We belong to Christ. He created us, and then later he purchased us by giving his own life for us. So we're his, we're owned by him. And one day, God's people will eventually be the in crowd, but it's not now. And this time, we've got to navigate through a world filled with Satan's hostility, filled with people's attitudes in which nobody can get any satisfaction, and people are so frustrated, and things are going wrong at every turn, it seems. But in order to be in God's in crowd, we've got to strive to live in a way that's acceptable to him. Further, our loyalty is often tested in this, and so we may have to suffer loss in order to stay with him. We're being pulled in many directions in life, but we've got to hang on and stay tethered, as my friend Dennis said. He uses that term saying tethered to God, but it's really referring to this being the branches that are intimately and intrinsically connected to the vine. John 15 and verse 20, the Savior says, remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they've persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they've kept my saying, they'll keep yours also. To me, this is an intriguing statement in a sense. That is, if they follow Christ's words, they'll follow the words of his disciples. But think what this means. Christ's disciples must be speaking the same thing that Christ would be speaking. Are we speaking the same way he would? Are we saying the same kinds of things? Are we living the same way Christ would live? Would he watch some of the movies we do? Would he go to some of the sites we visit on the computer? Or would he say, if your eye offends you, pluck it out? Would he do any kind of commercial business on the Sabbath? Would he advocate, don't prepare on the sixth day so we can justify buying food on the seventh day? Or would he say, only break the Sabbath to save life and property, that is, an ox in a ditch? Would he teach us to give an offering on atonement? Would he ever say the opposite of what the scriptures say? Because the holy day offerings were eaten by the people who offered them as well as the priest. But on atonement, no one was allowed to eat. Would he tell us to eat or drink far more than we should? Would he suggest pursuing materialism and riches like this world is encouraging us to do? In the context of us being branches attached to the vine that is him, what would we do? How lax have we allowed ourselves to become? If we look like the world, if we dress like them, if we talk like them, if we accept their values and standards, we belong to them. They accept us. But the closer we become to Christ, the less they will like us. Because as Paul says in Romans, you know, the carnal mind is enmity against God and is not subject to his law. So there's an enmity, a hostility that's natural in every person's flesh. And that enmity will come out against us in the end. And it's always done this through in God's people throughout the ages and historically. John 15, verse 21 says this, "But all these things will they do unto you for my name's sake, because they know not him that sent me." So, it's still about the Father. There's a way that the Father lives, and it's the only way that works. It's the only way that people can live in peace and harmony and happiness for all eternity. And from the time of Adam and Eve, we've rejected that way, and instead we've decided we can determine ourselves what's right and wrong. So, in this context, Jesus Christ came to magnify the law and make it honorable. In other words, he showed the right and honorable way to keep God's law of love. Therefore, there is no excuse. There's no real argument against the law that can work. And so he says in verse 22, "If I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin. But now they have no cloak for their sin." Because his behavior, his attitude, his actions uncovered our immorality. It uncovers our human nature and our self-centeredness. And this is why men do not like the idea of a God today. This is why atheism is growing in our country. Because his existence declares that there is, in fact, a moral authority in life. And human nature resents any authority over it. And so he says in verse 23, "He that hates me hates my Father also." So this is why I believe the Protestant community plays so heavily on one single doctrine. Their mantra, if you let me say it that way, is freedom in Christ. But what do they mean by that? Well, what they mean is freedom from the law. The Son of God was human. He was a human being. He gave up. He shed the power. He took off his majesty and glory and became a human being just like all of us. He felt the same way all of us do. And he kept the law the way it was meant to be kept in God's intent and his purpose. And as the scriptures say, he was the example we are to follow. But now, because he's come and he's done this and he's talked the truth, he's explained the meaning of the law, he's explained it and he's lived it, we have, as mankind, we have no excuse, no real rationalization, no justification, unless we just somehow eliminate God from our being and just say he doesn't really exist and become atheistic. Verse 24, he says, "If I had not done among them the works which no other man did, they had not had sin. But now they have both seen and hated me and my Father." All of us, I think, have experienced this same thing at one time or another in our lives, that we've been hated without a cause. And I know that there was a case once where I went to a park where there was a minority there, and I went there on their side. I wanted to go to support their cause, and but they didn't know that, and they crowded around me, and they began attacking me, and they were kicking me, and and I ended up in a fetal position on the ground while it seems like hundreds of them were kicking me and stuff. But the thing that I remember most was how I was looking in the eyes of those that were staring at me, and I was never a prejudiced person, and so I didn't really understand this. But for the first time in my life, I looked in the eyes of these people, and they hated me. They loathed me for what I was, and I'd never, ever seen that before. Now, some guys came, and they shot up in the air, some blanks probably, and the people dispersed, and my friends helped me get to the car, and I was okay. But, you know, what lingers in my mind is this issue of how I felt to be hated without a cause. In fact, I was there to support their cause, but they didn't understand that. They couldn't see it, that my presence there wasn't to mock or ridicule them, but it was to support them, and they attacked. In verse 25, he says, "But this comes to pass that the word might be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause." And I can relate to those people that are of other races that were persecuted severely by the Caucasian community. But I never knew that until this moment when I saw the eyes filled with hatred, and when I had done nothing to deserve that. And that story I told earlier, Mr. Weiser was hated by Larry Trapp without a cause. There was no cause. But it continued until he came to know Weiser personally. And it's the same with the people in the world. They may dislike our differences now. They may come to hate us like they hated Christ. They may persecute us. And the reason is because they don't really know us. And so even in this case, at this time, the 12 disciples did not fully know Jesus Christ. They didn't really understand him. It wasn't until they received the Spirit that they fully understood and had the mind of Christ living in them. And so in John 15 and verse 26 it says, "When the Comforter is come, that I will send you from the Father, even the Spirit of truth that proceeds from the Father, it shall testify of me." And so the Spirit comes from the Father. It is His, but it is distributed by Christ. Thus He said He had to go that He could be able to send the Spirit. And so that's what He does as a part of His responsibilities at the right hand of the Father as the high priest for all of us. So once we do have that Spirit, then we receive the mind of Christ. And then it is He who lives in us. Then we are to say and do the things that He would do. We are to be branches that live off Him, connected to Him. And we are to look and act like we're one with Him. And by this, the disciples would bear witness of the truth of Christ. But now, it's our time. It's your time and it's my time to be like those disciples of Christ at that time. And we are to bear witness in our lives of Jesus Christ and the Father. And so in verse 27, he concludes the chapter saying this, "And you also shall bear witness, because you've been with me from the beginning." Now he's talking about the disciples, but they bore witness, and then he spoke of others who would come after them, who would follow his word, and that we would be like sheep following a shepherd. And from this chapter, we realize at least this one point of enormous significance. You and I must stay connected to Christ. We receive the life-giving Spirit from him, and it gives us understanding, and it gives us the will to live his way. So let's continue to belong to him and strive to imitate his way no matter what life presents us. So that concludes the Bible study for this evening and this chapter. And we'll begin in chapter 16 next time. And so I want to thank everyone for tuning in and those for coming and attending this evening. And so until next time, thank you once again, and let's strive to live the way of God each day.